The account of David and Goliath is one of the top three most famous stories in the entire Old Testament. Everybody has heard about David and Goliath. The problem, though, is that almost always people get the message of the story wrong. Usually, when this text is taught, the message is that you need to be bold, and you need to be strong, and you need to be courageous. And when your Goliaths approach, when your giants approach you, like, I don't know, a mean boss or a bully at school, or, ooh, worst of all, low self-esteem. When those Goliaths come, you need to go to your nearby brook. You need to grab your five smooth stones, like prayer and Bible reading and meditation. You need to swing them on your giants and knock them dead because you're David in this story. That's what people usually get when they study this passage. But then we look at it and we realize that's not at all what it's about. To find what 1 Samuel 17 actually teaches, the narrator gives us two clues that we must be careful to spot and analyze. The first clue is a word that is repeated throughout the narrative six times, and it's implied 80 times. 80 times in that Goliath, verse 16 tells us that Goliath gave the same message to the Jews for 40 days every morning and every evening. So this word is everywhere, and that word is the word harap, or harap. I don't know how to pronounce it in Hebrew. It sounds like you're mad at your Chipotle rep. So it sounds like. But this word ultimately means to taunt, to deride, to insult. It's connected to blaspheming, and every time it's used here, it's used either of God being mocked or of the people of God being mocked. But either way, whether it's against God or the people of God, it's ultimately against God. It's the honor of God that's on the line. And then the second clue that we get is the dialogue, primarily the words that proceed out of the main character, out of his mouth, David. And what we find as we read the text is everything that comes out of his mouth is either indignation against the dishonor of God's name or exaltation towards God as the only one who can deliver them from Goliath. And so David's not the ultimate hero in the story. God is, and Israel's survival is not ultimately what's on the line, but the honor of God. And so putting these two clues together, for those of you who are taking notes, here's a summary statement of what the chapter teaches us. The chapter teaches us. 1 Samuel 17 delineates a battle for the honor of God that should work to ignite zeal in your heart for his honor. So 1 Samuel 17 delineates a battle for the honor of God that should work to ignite zeal in your heart for his honor. And I choose the word honor because honor, it speaks of respect and high esteem and reverence, whereas glory speaks more of praise and worship towards God. And certainly you worship God when you honor him. But the opposite of what Goliath is going to do, of the mocking that Goliath is going to do against God, is honor. The honor of God is on the line. Now, before we get to the actual battle, let me give you some context. The book of 1 Samuel takes place right after the book of Judges, which I know you're studying right now. And the book of Judges shows a nation that is running amok. And the last verse of the book tells us why that was. Judges 21:25 says, "In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes." So what was the problem? We have no king. We have no righteous king. We have no one to lead us, no one to guide us, no one to instruct us in God's will, in God's word. We have no one who is adequate to protect us from the enemies of God. We have no one to solve the problem of sin, which is the reason why our enemies keep coming and attacking us. So where is our righteous king? King, as we approach 1 Samuel, that's the theme that needs to be ringing in our ears, the utter need of a righteous king. And the coming of this righteous king has two guys in view. First of all, David, who is going to be the momentary king. But then ultimately, Christ, who will be the ultimate king, who will ultimately solve the problem of sin. And so this chapter is incredibly important, not only because it shows us a battle for God's honor, but because it introduces David as the momentary king that we're waiting for. And so a battle for God's honor, which introduces us, David, as the momentary king, as the man after God's own heart, as we're going to see, That's what we're going to study. So let's get into the text. And as I said, we're going to study a battle, and every battle has fighters. And fighters usually have really, really cool names. So let's outline the battle by the three fighters in the story, starting with fighter number one, Goliath, the metal giant. Goliath, the metal giant. Look at verse 1 with me. It says, "Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Succoth, which belongs to Judah, and they camped between Succoth and Azekah in Ephes-Damim. Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and camped in the valley of Elah, and drew up in battle array to encounter the Philistines. The Philistines stood on the mountain on one side, while Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, with the valley between them." So you have one army on a hill on one side, one army on a hill on the other side, right between them a valley in which a mighty war is about to take place. And you need to notice the way the narrator tells the story. He's setting the scene for a match that will make history. It's almost as if he wants you to just sit back, get some popcorn, and enjoy the show, because this is going to be an awesome fight. But before we get to the fight, let's get introduced to the first fighter. So you could say, again, this is a fight. So using our sanctified imagination, not that this happened. This is how I picture it. You look at this story. The narrator is painting the scene for an incredible fight. It's almost as if he were grabbing the mic and he starts saying, "On the left side, the Philistines' lucky charm, the Philistines' secret weapon, Goliath." It's crazy. Look at what happens in verse 4. "Then the champion came out from the armies of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath." This is supposed to intimidate you. This guy is going to be amazing. You can almost hear the rock music they usually play in boxing matches, you know, like he's getting ready and you hear, and the crowd is going crazy. Anyways, before we look at this guy, I want you to notice, first of all, what the narrator actually calls him. He calls him champion. He is the champion of the Philistines. And champion here literally means the man of the between. And it speaks of a guy who, a man who stands between the gap between one army and another. He is the representative of his people. This is a man who would be chosen as a hero of his people, who would fight another hero, another champion from an army. And that way, his army did not have to fight and die. That way, if he won the battle, his entire army won, and the entire other army lost. But if he lost the battle, then his entire army lost, and now they were subdued to the other army. So in a sense, this is the representative of his people. The champion, the man of the between, is the representative, the mediator, I would even say the savior of his people. And I hope that rings a bell. But that's what Goliath was to the Philistines. And then the narrator begins to describe him for us, and as he's coming out to fight. Look at verse 4 again. It says, "Then the champion came out from the armies of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits in a span." That's almost 10 feet tall. I mean, this guy is a giant. This guy is humongous. He's 3 feet taller than Shaq, y'all. I mean, people would have tried to look at the sun, and they wouldn't have been able to because his face would have blocked it. He's huge, all right? And if he's a giant, then we need to ask the question, where did he come from? Where did Goliath come from? Well, let me give you a short history on Goliath. The history of giants can be traced back to Genesis 6, but it's a whole sermon in itself. So I'm going to start in Numbers. You don't have to turn there. But if you all remember, in Numbers 13, Moses sent out spies to spy out the land of Canaan. And when they got there, they came back terrified, because what did they find in Canaan? Giants. They found giants. And so all the spies come back, except two of them. And all of them, except two, come back and they tell Moses, "Moses, I know you're telling us to trust God, but you don't understand, Moses. The Nephilim are there." That's what they call them. There's giants in that place. And they will destroy us, Moses. They will take our children and our wives. We're like grasshoppers in front of them, Moses. And it is because of that. Because of their disobedience and their lack of trust in God, because of their fear of the giants, that God made them walk for 40 years in the wilderness until that entire generation, 20 years and up, was dead, because they feared giants more than they trusted God. And then the story continues, and We arrive at Joshua 15 and see that once they had taken possession of the promised land, Joshua divides the land. And in Joshua 15, verse 14, it says that Caleb drove out from there the children of Anak, the giant. And so Caleb drives these giants out of Canaan, and therefore the giants who survived were now fugitives, confined to find refuge in certain Philistine cities nearby, one of which was Gath, which is where Goliath comes from. And so Goliath is a descendant of fugitive giants who were driven out from their homeland by Caleb in Joshua 15. And also, if you remember in 1 Samuel 5, if you've read this book, it tells us that Gath was one of the cities that endured the judgment of God when the Philistines took the ark. And so you got to understand, guys, this is Goliath knows who the Jews are. There's history here. He's had beef with them since he was little, most likely. And not only that, but I mean, his entire life, he would have been wondering, why is it that I live amongst midgets? Why is it that I live with the Philistines? Oh, it is because the Jews drove my family and my people out of our home. So Goliath is not neutral here. He's been waiting probably for this moment his entire life, the moment he can kill the Jews. But let's keep going. The narrator now gives us the description of Goliath's armor. Verse 5. It says, he, Goliath, had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was clothed with scale armor, which weighed 5,000 shekels of bronze. It says he also had bronze greaves on his legs and a bronze javelin slung between his shoulders. Notice the repetition. Bronze, 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 bronze. This is a metal giant. Verse 7. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, meaning that his spear was so thick. It's like a weaver's beam. You couldn't hold it, all right? But he could, because he's a giant. And it says that the head of his spear weighed 600 shekels of iron. That's 15.1 pounds just for the head of the spear. That's a bowling ball right there. And lastly, we're told that his shield carrier also walked before him. So this guy had like 130 pounds of armor on him, and his shield was so large that an additional person had to carry it for him. It's wild. And what's the point in all of this, guys? That he was terrifying. He was absolutely terrifying. Now, let's look at what this metal giant had to say. Verse 8. It says, he stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel and said to them, why do you come out to draw up in battle array? Am I not the Philistine? Not by blood, he wasn't. And you servants of Saul? And notice this. Choose a man for yourselves, and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will become your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall become our servants and serve us. Again, the Philistine said, I defy the ranks of Israel this day. That's our word, by the way, the Harab word. Give me a man that we may fight together. Pick a man, Goliath says. Your strongest man, your greatest man, your knight of knights and soldier of soldiers, that he may stand as a man of the between and fight me. Pick a mediator. Pick a representative of his people. Pick a savior, someone who will save you. A ruler who will stand there in the gap for you. Guys, this is the guy that 1 Samuel is in desperate search of. This is the guy that Judges is in desperate search of. This is the guy, I would even say, that the entire Bible is crying out for. His righteous king, a righteous champion, a man who will stand between God's people and their greatest threat. And there's another sense in which this is a cry for a man who will stand for the honor of God's name. God is being mocked and no one is willing to stand against it. We see that in verse 11. Notice it. It says, when Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistines, they were infuriated that God would be so mocked. Now, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. All these people think about is their safety. Yet God is so great and he's so worthy of honor that he will choose the most unlikely means to destroy this giant. And so we come to our second fighter in this story. Goliath has been presented in the ring, and the narrator now grabs the mic again, and he says, now on the right side, David! And nobody claps. Nobody claps. In fact, his description is so ironic that we're going to title this guy David the Hobbit. David the Hobbit. That's our second fighter. And so you have an insurmountable threat of death in the horizon. And then the narrator moves us from the battlefield to the peaceful, humble, childlike Shire. And there you spot him, the Hobbit who will save the day. And so his fighter theme song would be the Hobbit song. You know, like, do-do-do-do-do-do-do. You know what I'm talking about, right? If you have not listened to that song, you need to, all right? Because it's the best song ever composed in the history of the world. Anyways, look at verse 12. Now David was the son of the Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah, whose name was Jesse. And he had 8 sons. And Jesse was old in the days of Saul, advanced in years among men. The 3 older sons of Jesse had gone after Saul to the battle. And the names of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab the firstborn, and the second to him, Abinadab, and the third, Shammah. Verse 14, David was the youngest. Now the 3 oldest followed Saul. But David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's flock at Bethlehem. So we find out a couple of things about David here. First of all, we learn that he's the youngest of 8. We also learn that he's a youth. He's not even old enough to fight in a battle. He had to be at least 20 years old to do that. So he's probably a 17-year-old here. And implied in being a youth, of course, is the fact that he most likely had no military experience. And in addition to that, in verse 15, we're told that he is a shepherd boy. And that's most likely because, again, he was the youngest. And so he's given the job that nobody wants to take. And that shows, by the way, that he was also humble and obedient. Because in the last chapter, he finds out he's going to be the new king. And it's not like he's looking at his parents, as his dad and his brothers, and he's like, listen, people, I mean, you need to be careful how you talk to me, because soon I'm going to be able to send you to the dungeons, all right? He doesn't do that. He just obeys. He's faithful in the little things. But if we combine all these things about David, we really learn that he's not really special at all, in the eyes of the world, at least. I mean, he has no royal line. He's not a big shot. He's not the mightiest and strongest and most trained warrior in the world. And yet again, this is a guy that God is going to use. And that reminds you that God is not in the business of using the most popular, mighty blue bloods of the world. But he's in the business of using weak, humble, meek, obedient, holy, faithful, again, weak people. Because through it, he gains all the glory. Now, let's look at the circumstances that David found himself in. Look at verse 16. It says, the Philistine, Goliath, came forward morning and evening for 40 days and took his stand. So for 40 days, twice a day, Goliath is coming out. He's saying the same thing. Give me a man of the between who will stand with me. And he keeps taunting and mocking God. And Jesse and David, being far away from the battle, have no idea that this is going on. But one day, Jesse seems to have gotten nervous about his 3 sons at war. Because notice what he does in verse 17. It says, then Jesse said to David, his son, take now for your brothers an ephah of this roasted grain and these 10 loaves and run to the camp to your brothers. Bring also these 10 cuts of cheese to the commander of the household and look into the welfare of your brothers and bring back news of them. For Saul and they and all the men of Israel are in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. Well, that's not exactly what they were doing. But essentially, what Jesse tells David is to walk to the battlefield, to walk to the camp of the Jews, which was about 15 miles away, and deliver food and bring back news about his brothers. And guys, this is a setting that God's going to use to expose David as his chosen man, as the future king. And isn't it amazing that David had no idea of what was about to happen? David is just being faithful in his duties. He's just being faithful in the little things. And providentially, God says, all right, today is the day I expose you to the world. It's really cool. And that teaches you that God sometimes acts in the times when you least expect it. Or as a commentator put it, in God's providence, ordinary situations can be the beginning of extraordinary things. And that applies not only to David, but it applies to you as well. And like David, your job is not to try and look for great opportunities for yourself. Your job is not to try to expose yourself as the big hero of the story, but to simply be faithful in the little things and to trust God to open the doors, if that is his will. Now, verse 20 says, so David arose early in the morning and left the flock with the keeper and took the supplies and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the circle of the camp while the army was going out in battle array, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines drew up in battle array, army against army. Then David left his baggage in the care of the baggage keeper and ran to the battle line and entered in order to greet his brothers. 23. As he was talking with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine from Gath, named Goliath, was coming up from the army of the Philistines, and he spoke these same words, and David heard them. And the moment he heard them was a turning point in redemptive history. Never will redemptive history be the same after David hears these words. And I think there's an emphasis on the verb to hear here. David would have seen Goliath like everybody else, but what stood out to David was not the size of Goliath, but his words, which shows us another theme running throughout the chapter, how man sees versus how God sees. In the previous chapter, in chapter 16, the main lesson is that man looks at the physical appearance, but God looks at the heart. And so you look at this chapter, and throughout it, everyone judges Goliath for his size. He's a giant. And everyone judges David for his size. He's a hobbit. And the only person in the entire story who doesn't do that is David. He doesn't look at the physical appearance. He looks at the heart, and out of the heart, words. Well, no. I'm getting confused with this verse. From the heart, the mouth speaks. And he just listened to words that reflect a rotten heart. And by the way, this may have been the first time in David's entire life that he would have heard the mocking of God. And so the next verses show us how he responded to it. And not only does it show us how he responded to the mocking of God, but it will also show us the characteristic of David, which helps us best define what it means to be a man or a woman after God's own heart. David is called a man after God's own heart. But what does that mean? How does that look like? Well, let's look at how David responds, and we get an answer. And essentially, what we're going to find is, to be a man or a woman after God's own heart is to be consumed with zeal for the glory of God. To be a man or a woman after God's own heart is to be consumed with zeal for the glory and honor of God. Everything David is about to say proceeds out of a heart that cannot stand the mocking of God. He lives for the honor of God. Let's examine this, starting in verse 24. When all the men of Israel saw the man, Goliath, they fled from him and were greatly afraid. Again, they're looking at the physical appearance. 25, the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who is coming up? Surely he is coming up to defy Israel." That's our word again. "And it will be that the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel." So again, I mean, everybody's looking at Goliath's size. They're terrified. They're running from him like bugs about to be squished by a giant. They are terrified. No one's willing to fight him. And so Saul decides to convince them a different way, to convince them to fight him a different way. And by the way, this is going to be pathetic of Saul. Because chapter 9, verse 16, God says that Saul was appointed king. It says, to deliver my people from the hand of the Philistines. It's like this guy had one job, all right? And now he's getting somebody, he's trying to bribe someone else to do it. Okay, not only that, but Israel had their own giant. He was taller than everybody in the nation of Israel. They have their giant. They have their champion. What's he doing? He's a coward. He's doing nothing. And so this is what he says to the men. To anyone who kills Goliath, he says, I'll give you three things. I'm going to give you my daughter, which is messed up, by the way. I'm going to give you riches and no taxes. And I work with youth guys, and every 17-year-old dude that I know, if he hears that, he'd be like, woohoo, that's a deal right there. You get the girl, you get riches, you get no taxes. That's it. But David does not respond like that at all. His response is entirely different. Look at what he says in verse 26. By the way, these are the first words ever recorded in the entire Bible from the mouth of David, meaning the narrator is waiting to reveal David until now. He wants us to see, I would say, his zeal for the glory of God. 26. Then David spoke to the men who were standing by him, saying, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel?" That's the same word. "For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God?"
So David asks this question.
What is going to be done? What's going to be given to the guy who does this?
And in asking this, I don't think he's asking for clarification or for self-esteem,
for self-interest. Again, everything he's going to say
goes back to the honor of God. And so he's most likely asking this because he doesn't seem to understand why Saul has to place a bait for the men to stand and fight. It's almost as if he were saying, is there no reason to fight? Is the honor of God's name too small a thing for you to stand up against Goliath? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine? That's an insult. That he should taunt the armies of the living God.
Notice also, by the way, how so far the past couple of verses have shown everybody call Goliath the man, and yet David calls him this uncircumcised Philistine who taunts the armies of the living God. He's insulting Goliath. He's angry at Goliath. He's appalled that anybody would dare to dishonor God in such a way.
I got to stop here, guys, and ask you, how do you respond when God is dishonored? How do you respond when God is mocked? How do you respond to your own sin that dishonors God? How do you respond when you hear and see people dishonor God? Later on, David would write, "Zeal for your house is eating me up. Zeal for your house consumes me. Zeal for your honor consumes me." Is that you? Are you consumed with zeal for the honor of God?
I remember hearing about a missionary. I think his name was Henry Martin, and he says he was in India, and he saw the idolatrous Indian temples, and he wrote down,
"I cannot endure existence if my Lord will be so dishonored. Just kill me now. I cannot live. I cannot continue to live if he will be so dishonored. I cannot bear it. I'd just rather die."
I remember also about 6 years ago, Sarah and I, my wife and I, we were shepherded by this couple that we love dearly. And I remember about 6 years ago, we were at a different church, and the lady in this relationship, she came up to us, and she was so sad, and she told us that she had just found out that to say OMG and say God was blasphemy, and she came to us and she was like, "I can't believe I've been saying this my entire life. I have been blaspheming my Lord my entire life. How could I have done that?" That's the way we should respond, guys, to the dishonor of God's name.
Listen, whether it is in your own life as you continue to kill your sin that dishonors God, or whether it is that you have to stand against the dishonor of God through someone else that's dishonoring God, you will face what David is facing in this text. It may not be as public, as glorious. You may not be crowned king or queen in the end, and yet you will have to make the choice. Will I go with the flow, or will I stand for the honor of God?
Maybe you refuse to sin with your friends because God would not be honored by it, so you're scorned for it. Maybe you refuse to endure the blasphemy of God from the lips of your coworkers, and so you lovingly pull them aside and you tell them, "Listen, you are blaspheming your Creator, and He is holy, and He will not be mocked, and you will be judged, and He is worthy of all honor." Maybe you're at a family gathering, and you hear the mocking of God from a family member who perhaps is in a false religion, or perhaps adamantly goes against God, and you need to stand up and say, "That is not the God of the Bible, but an idol you speak of, because the God of the Bible is holy, and He is worthy of all honor." You will have to make the choice. In those moments, whose reputation will matter most to you, yours or God's? What will you do?
Now let's keep going in the text. Before David meets Goliath, he will have two interactions with two people who resemble Goliath, in that they see as man sees, and in that they will present David with two hurdles to jump before he actually gets to Goliath. Two interactions that could have stopped David from doing what he was doing if his heart was not in the right place. And the first interaction
David has is with his brother. So look at verse 28. It says, now Eliab, his brother, his oldest brother, heard when he, David, spoke to the men. And Eliab's anger burned against David, and he said, why have you come down? Notice, by the way, those are the same words that Goliath just said to the Jews. Why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? Those few sheep. It's like little David. Listen, David. You're nothing but a little insignificant sheep with little insignificant sheep. Where'd you leave your sheep? Irresponsible David. I know your insolence and the wickedness of your heart, for you have come down in order to see the battle. You don't care about God's honor. You're just here for the show. He sees this man sees. But David said, 29, what have I done now? Was it not just a question? And he turned away from him and to another and said the same thing about Goliath. And the people answered the same thing as before. David doesn't care what his brother has to say. I mean, he's laser focused on the honor of God. And sometimes, guys, we can be so preoccupied with what people think of us and how people see us that we forget that our purpose is to live for the honor of God. But David does not forget. David is not preoccupied with what people think of him. Because again, he lives for the reputation of God, not his own. And that's the way we need to live. So what does it matter? If anybody thinks anything of us, that's not true. If we are laser focused on God gaining glory, on glorifying and honoring God. And so it seems that David turns aside and he's going from camp to camp to camp saying the same thing to all the soldiers in Israel. It's like, what's wrong with you people? Are you not hearing what this giant is saying about God? And he makes such a fuss about it that it reaches the ear of King Saul. And so we come to our second interaction, and this one is with Saul. 31. It says, when the words which David spoke were heard, they told them to Saul, and he sent for him. So this is a 17-year-old dude in front of the king, and you would think that he's going to be shy, all right? That's how most teenagers would be, but look at what he says. Verse 32. David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail on account of him. This is funny. He just takes charge. He doesn't even allow Saul to talk. He's like, king, don't allow anybody to fear because of this giant, and don't you dare fear, king. And then he tells us why. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine, he says. I love this. By the way, notice, he doesn't even ask for permission. He says, listen, I'm getting the job done because I'm getting the job done. He's acting like the king. Everything that Saul was supposed to be, David is proving to be. Look at Saul's response, verse 33. Then Saul said to David, you are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, while he has been a warrior from his youth. So, like everybody else, Saul sees as man sees. He's like, dude, you're going to get squished. You're a kid. And notice that this is not a remark only. This is a command. This is the king. He just said, you're not able to go. It's like most likely the guard is already walking towards David, about to say, listen, kid, I mean, he said, no, get out. But instead of that, David brings his resume. Look at verse 34. But David said to Saul, your servant was tending his father's sheep when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock. I went out after him and attacked him and rescued it from his mouth. And when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Oh, this is good. This is a man's man. This probably happened when he was like 13 years old. This is a 13-year-old punching a bear or lion to death. I mean, he's fearless. I love it. 36. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, since he has taunted the armies of the living God. Notice how he puts Goliath on the same level as the lion and the bear. He's saying, this guy is so irrational, and he has lowered himself to such a degree in dishonoring God that he has placed himself on the same level as a brute beast. That's how irrational dishonoring God is. 37. And David said, the Lord, who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear. He will deliver me from the hand of the Philistine. He's saying, please don't get me wrong, king. Don't think that I'm saying I'm going to do it. God will do it. God is the giant slayer, not me. He's going to do it. Listen, there is no ounce of self-esteem in David. For those people who teach that this teaches us to have self-confidence and self-esteem, it's actually a passage against it. The only self-confident guy in the story is Goliath, and he's about to get his head chopped off, all right? And so rather than self-confidence, this passage teaches us to have God confidence. David is a man whose confidence is placed on God alone. David has a big God, and because he has a big God, he has big faith in his big God. Now, how big is your God? How high is your view of God? Because your faith will be determined by that. The way you respond to trials will be determined by your view of God. The way you respond to life will be determined by your view of God. The way you respond to people like Saul, who can't stop worrying, will be determined by your view of God. Do you know the God of the Bible? Do you know how awesome he is? Are you constantly studying the Bible to get to know who your God is if you claim to be a Christian? Better do so. Now, let's continue. David shows this God confidence, and then Saul says at the end of verse 37, in light of it, go, and may the Lord be with you. And for a second, you think, man, Saul seems to be trusting God here. But then verse 38 happens. It says, then Saul clothed David with his garments and put a bronze helmet on his head, and he clothed him with armor. So essentially, Saul says, go, and may the Lord be with you. But let me put my armor on you, because I think you're going to be killed without it. So it's like, may the Lord be with you, but let me give you my armor, because I don't actually believe that the Lord will be with you. So everything he's doing contradicts his words. Verse 39, David girded his sword over his armor and tried to walk, for he had not tested them. So David said to Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them. And David took them off. He took his stick in his hand and chose for himself 5 smooth stones from the brook and put them in the shepherd's bag, which he had, even his pouch, and his sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. This is a man who trusted his God. And that leads us to the third and final fighter, with the coolest name, by the way, Yahweh, the giant slayer. Yahweh, the giant slayer. Look at verse 41. 41. It says, then the Philistine, Goliath, came on and approached David, with a shield bearer in front of him. When the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy with a handsome appearance. And so, again, like everybody else, he sees as men see. The Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? He's just offended. This is not a worthy opponent, basically. So he hated David because of it. And then look at the end of verse 43. It says, and the Philistine cursed David by his gods, and therefore revealing that, again, this is not a fight between two peoples or two people groups or two people. This is a fight between the gods. Whose God is worthy of most honor? Whose God will destroy the other God? Who will gain the glory and the honor and the reputation in the end? 44, the Philistine also said to David, come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field. Imagine the scene. This is the real deal. This is not a passive guy he's dealing with. He is promising David to kill him and break him and feed him to the birds. Place yourself in David's shoes. How would you respond? Well, look at verse 45. How did David respond? David said to the Philistines, and mind you, they're not very close to each other. They're yelling at each other. And so he would have said this, he would have yelled this out from the top of his lungs with a fury and tenacity in his eyes. This is what he says. You come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin. Notice, by the way, in verse 43, Goliath was offended in verse 43 because he saw David coming to him with a staff, and now David returns the insult and humiliates Goliath's weapons.
Because David comes with a far superior weapon, with a far superior advantage. You come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. I love that. Notice again the point of the story. It is God whom you have taunted. It is God whom you have dishonored. And so the narrator now, instead of introducing God as the final fighter, he lets David do so. He's the one who's about to destroy you. Verse 46. This day the Lord will deliver you up into my hands, and I will strike you down. And he's going to do this with stones, right? That's most likely, again, because he knew his Bible. It may be that he read Leviticus 24:16, where it says that anybody who blasphemed God had to be stoned to death. And it may be that he chooses a stone as his weapon of choice because he's looking at Goliath and he's saying, listen, you have blasphemed God and therefore you need to die by stoning. And that's exactly what I'm going to do. I will strike you down, keep reading, and remove your head from you, and I will give the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth. Goliath said he would only do that to David, but now David's saying, listen, you and all of your army will be fed to the birds. And again, you marvel at this level of bravery and confidence and courage, but then David gives the reason behind it. It's like, why, David? Why this passion? Why this bravery? Why are you so enraged? In the verse 46, he's doing this that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. So again, what drove David? What propelled David? An all-consuming, all-gripping passion for the honor of God. He's standing out here because of that. God's glory. He must be glorified. Verse 48. Then it happened when the Philistine rose and came and drew near to meet David that David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. So Goliath simply drew near, and yet David is running quickly, it says, and he is determined. He will not stop. They are about to meet. There is no going back. And as David is running as fast as possible, look at verse 49. And David put his hand into his bag and took from it a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. And the stone sank into his forehead so that he fell on his face to the ground. Can you imagine the scene? I love art. I've seen a lot of drawings, a lot of paintings apparently portraying this scene. And they're all weak. All right? Well, not all of them, some of them. And they just show David, like, he's standing around, like, all passive, and he it looks like he just went, boop, and Goliath, you know, falls down. That's not what this shows. I mean, he has all the momentum he could get, so much that the stone sank into Goliath's forehead, meaning it pierced his skull like a bullet. Verse 50. Thus David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, and he struck the Philistine and killed him. But there was no sword in David's hand. And then David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. Irony of ironies, the greatest warrior beheaded with his own sword by a hobbit. Keep reading in verse 51. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. The men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the valley and to the gates of Ekron. And the slain Philistines lay along the way to Sherem, even to Gath and Ekron, becoming food for birds, by the way. 53, the sons of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines and plundered their camps. And wouldn't you say that that would be a great ending to the story? It's like, man, God has been honored. David is, I mean, he's, after this, he's going to be recognized. This is the man. And God has now killed the enemy of Israel. That would be a great ending. But that's not enough for David. He's not done. He doesn't just stop there and say, all right, job is done, ready to play video games or something. You know? No. His heart is pounding for the honor of God. So look at what he does in verse 54.
Then David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem. But he put his weapons in his tent. This is very interesting, guys, because Jerusalem comes until 2 Samuel. So this Jerusalem is not the Jerusalem you know. This Jerusalem was under Gentile captivity. Not Gentile captivity, Gentile possession. The Jebusites were here, and these were enemies of God. And so what you have here is this 17-year-old guy parading around the Gaga ball-sized head of the fiercest giant. And he's carrying it throughout the city. Why? To give a message. We're not afraid of you, but you should be afraid of us, because this is what happens to anybody who dishonors God. So you better watch out. And we learned something else in all of that, by the way. Not only that we have a great God worthy of great honor, but we learned that in the end, God will gain the victory against all his enemies, like Goliath. All of God's enemies will perish. David is a type of Christ who kills the enemies of God, and then one day Christ will come and will destroy all the wicked of the earth. That's why they're told, the kings are told to kiss the Son lest he be angry, to pay homage, to honor the Son lest he be angry, and they perish in the way. And so another lesson of the chapter is this: to every human in the world, either you bow or you perish. Either you bow or you burn. Because God is worthy of all the glory in the world, and in the end, he will be glorified, whether it is through saving his enemies or crushing them. Let's finish the passage. The last couple of verses shows the contrast between David and Saul. In a sense, David is undoing what Saul had done. Saul had been an incompetent, evil king. Look at verse 55. Now, when Saul saw David going out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is this young man?" And Abner said, "By your life, O king, I do not know." The king said, "You inquire whose son the youth is." So when David returned from killing the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the Philistine's head in his hand. Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of your servant, Jesse the Bethlehemite." This is very interesting, because Saul is acting as if he hadn't met David, and he had. In fact, he had asked David previously to become his harp player. And so the picture here is that of an incompetent king who cannot even remember the guy, the boy whom he loved to hear play the harp. And on the other side, a young man holding by the hair with his bloody hands the head of the enemy of Israel. This is a sobering picture. This is an incompetent king who just lost his kingdom and a victorious king who just gained it. For the very first time, guys, we can say that in 1 Samuel and Judges, we can say that the king has been found. The momentary king has been found. And even though the main message of the story is God and his worthiness of honor, I think it's appropriate to say that David is the type of Christ, not only in that he is a man after God's own heart, and not only in that he has zeal for the honor of God, and not only in that Christ will come through him, but also in that God uses him to defeat the greatest physical problem that the people of God had. He became the man of the between. He became the mediator of his people, like Christ became our mediator, our Savior, our man of the between, who defeated sin and death and judgment and the wrath of God that we deserved. And so you look at this story and you go back to the beginning. Who are we in this story? If there's anybody here that we represent, is it David? No. Is it Goliath? Let's hope not. If we're believers, guys, who depend entirely on God's grace and power to destroy our greatest threat, we would have to be the weak, cowardly Israelites trembling in the background because of Goliath. But then our men of the between arrives, our mediator arrives, and he rescues us, and he saves us, and we are saved now, not because we're David, but because he fought our battle and he was victorious. What a great God we have, a great God worthy of all honor. If you don't know this God, you need to bow to him. You need to run to him and beg for mercy. And you need to marvel at who he is, because he is amazing. And you need to understand that all his enemies will perish, so you need to fear. And you need to understand also that he will save anybody who turns to him. And if you do know him, then you need to spend the rest of your life growing in your knowledge of him. growing in zeal for his honor, because that's what you were made for. Not only that, but I mean, you guys are probably, I think I'm your age. How old are you guys? Who's the oldest here? Not leader, sorry. How old are you? 24. Oh, 24. Y'all are babies. I'm just kidding. I'm 25. All right. Well, we are in what may be, if I'm not speaking for you, I'm speaking for myself, one of the most frustrating seasons of my life. Why? Because it's like, what are we going to do? What are we going to be in the future? Who are you going to marry? How does my future look like? You want to know the first step in that process that you need to take? Resolve to live for the glory and honor of God. Resolve to be a man or a woman after God's own heart. That's what you were made for. And that's what God is worthy of. Pray with me. We honor you, Lord. And we praise you for who you are. You are amazing. You are wonderful. And we thank you that we get to be here and listen to your word being taught every Sunday, every Wednesday, that we may grow in awe of you. We ask you that we would. We ask you that you would gain glory from us, from our hearts, that we would be men and women after your own heart, zealous for your honor. In Jesus' name, amen.